Washington, D.C., and I passed around my really, really exciting green flyers to let you know a little bit more about our program. So while you're in Washington, you remain completely enrolled at UCLA, so it's kind of like going abroad inside the United States. While you're there, you complete a research paper on the topic of your choice, and you do an internship that's usually kind of connected to that. So one of the great things about this program is that whatever you're passionate about, you can make this program work for you. You get to choose your research topic and you get to choose your internship. So whatever you want to make this experience, it can be like the best thing in the world because it's all up to you. So I went there in spring of 2011, my good friend Monica. and while we were there, I interned at the American Red Cross and I wrote my research paper about the state of healthcare in Haiti a year after the earthquake. And it really helped me decide what I wanted to do with, you know, the rest of my life. So we take people in three main departments: political science, history, and sociology, but we encourage people of all majors to come and participate. We have an information session later today from 5 to 6 in Rolf Hall behind Royce. But if you can't come to that or you can't come to some of the other ones, feel free to stop by our office in Rolf 2133. Oh, and I forgot to mention, one of the best things about this is that financial aid pays. So if financial aid pays for you to attend UCLA, financial aid will pay for you to attend the CAP quarter in Washington. So I hope you guys have a great class. Thank you so much.
Okay. Did you you like the program when you were there?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, especially if you go in spring, you kind of get to see like D.C. in the winter and D.C. in the summer. And then I was there when I interned on Capitol Hill for Senator Boxer. So I was there when the government almost shut down and when they killed Osama bin Laden. So that was really scary / interesting.
Okay. So actually, if you're interested in this program, talk with her because she'll give you the honest insight.
It's really fun.
Yeah. That's what I've heard. People respond very favorably to it. Oh, okay. Anyway, today I'm going to be talking about the period, from 1919 to 1923, the immediate post-Versailles period. The last couple of lectures was on the Treaty of Versailles. What's important to remember about the Treaty of Versailles, the essence of the political system established by the Treaty of Versailles, it's a system that establishes a certain structure of power in Europe. See, in the absence of a set of constraints on German power, in the absence of various measures that are enforced that are designed to keep German power limited, Germany would be by far the strongest country on the continent of Europe, because Germany's war-making power, her industrial potential, was much greater than that of any other power in Europe. Well, what's the proof of that? The First World War itself. Here's Germany, basically, with only a weak ally, Austria-Hungary. Germany able to take on the three next most important powers of Europe all by herself. She probably would have won if the Americans hadn't intervened. That's a measure of what Germany's power was even in 1914. And if you just look at the map, the post-war map, you could see how Germany's position was relatively stronger after 1919 than it had been in 1914, if one forgets about the Versailles constraints. As I say, the Treaty of Versailles was a set of constraints, a system of constraints on German power, designed to keep Germany from dominating Europe the way she would have in the absence of those constraints. Why is Germany's position in 1919 better from the German standpoint than it had been in 1914? Well, what's the counterweight to German power in Europe, on the continent of Europe? Americans have pulled out, don't forget. You know, a lot of this has to do with this basic Wilsonian conception of the role of force in international politics. You know, he's a liberal, he's not a realist, he doesn't view power as playing a normal, natural, legitimate role in international political life. You know, it's used for moral purposes, the Germans have committed a crime, the Germans are crushed, then we can go home, right? And the Americans, well before the Republicans took control of the White House in the spring of 1921. Well before that, when Wilson was still president, the Americans withdrew from Europe. As a matter of fact, the basic decision was made practically the same week that the armistice was signed. You know, Wilson's own expression, we threw the harness off. All the wartime controls were dismantled. The flow of money to the Allies that had helped the Allies prosecute the war is like stopped practically overnight. No equivalent to the Marshall Plan that you had after World War II. Nothing like that after World War I. We have to give, and again, this is another Wilson phrase, we give with a stinted hand, you know, because these people, they can't make a patsy out of Uncle Sam. They have to rely on themselves. We're not going to continue footing the bill for the Europeans. They should be grateful for what they got from us. Now we can go home. The dragon has been slayed. We don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. That's not just a view associated with isolationist Republicans. That's an attitude that is deeply embedded in the American political culture on a kind of bipartisan basis. Anyway, what's the counterweight to German power in Europe? Well, in the West you have France. Yeah, France is relatively weaker vis-a-vis Germany on a one-on-one basis than she had been in 1914, because the French had suffered disproportionately greater losses in the war than Germany had. You know, almost as many Frenchmen were killed during the war, 1.3 million as opposed to 1.5 million Germans. But the German population is half again as great as France. All right, so basically 60 million versus 40 million. You know, that's the bloodletting of France was disproportionately greater than Germany. And as far as the East is concerned, in 1914 you had a major counterweight to German power in the East, Tsarist Russia, Imperial Russia, right? They had, Russia and Germany had a common military border. There was no independent Poland in 1914. You know, there was a border, and this green line here is the border that separated Imperial Russia from the German Reich, German Empire. Right. What did that mean? The existence of a common military border. So that means that if you're the Germans, you're going to have to worry about the threat of a Russian invasion. You're going to have to worry about what major military presence in your east is going to force you to divide your forces and make it harder for you to deal with any threat in the west. Now you don't have that anymore. You know, Russia is very weak. It's a product of the war itself, plus the Bolshevik Revolution and the Russian Civil War that it led to in the post-war period. Russia is bound to be preoccupied with their own internal problems, building herself up. This is a Russia which, for ideological reasons, is going to find it hard to have decent relations with the Western democracies. So you don't have to worry nearly as much about your adversaries ganging up against you. Plus, the existence of a new state, a buffer state between Russia and Germany, namely Poland, resurrected now after World War I, after not having been in existence since the 18th century. Poland used to be a very large and important country in the Middle Ages, early modern times, and then in these three partitions of Poland in the late 18th century, Poland, you know, was divided up among the three Eastern empires, you know, basically ultimately between the German Empire, the Austrian Empire, and the Russian Empire. Now Poland comes back into existence. Not a particularly strong country, but geographically Poland separates Russia from Germany. And Poland, having been recreated essentially by the Western democracies, the resurrection of Poland was one of the 14 points, after all. And France had certain ties with Poland as well. What this meant is, if Soviet power ever did revive, and the Soviets contemplated putting military pressure on Germany by moving through Poland to invade German territory, the Soviets would have to move through Poland. And that invasion of Poland would act as a kind of tripwire, bringing the Western powers into the game on the side of Poland. So basically, that would tend to deter the Soviets from moving through Poland and thus prevent them from putting pressure on Germany. Frees Germany, gives Germany a freer hand to act in the West if she doesn't have to worry about what's going on in the East. Right? You know, I should say for the same reason, the creation of Poland helped the Russians because it tended to shield them from unilateral German pressure. And in fact, we'll see in the 1930s, 1939, when the Germans contemplated a policy of Eastern expansion, which, you know, entailed ultimately the invasion of Poland, well, that triggered a military intervention of the Western powers on Poland's behalf in 1939. You know, that's a benefit for the Soviets. So a common military border is a source of weakness. When you create a buffer area of that sort, it tends to give you a free hand. That's a source of strength. So for these reasons, Germany, absent the Versailles constraints, would be in a stronger position post-World War I than she had been in even prior to World War I when she was strong enough. Right? In the absence of constraints on German power, Germany would naturally become the dominant power in Europe. German power would naturally overwhelm France, the second most important power in Europe. Germany is a much stronger country inherently than France. Therefore, you couldn't rely on a natural balance of power to restrain Germany, given that Britain and America were no longer interested in playing that role, in maintaining the wartime alliance with France, in maintaining large military forces in northern France. No equivalent to NATO after World War I, don't forget. France was on her own. France had to worry about Germany without being able to count on the support of her previous wartime allies, Britain and America. The Versailles system has to be understood in that context. You couldn't simply say to the Germans, oh, well, we fought the war, it's all over now. There should be no constraints on your power. You should be free to build up your armaments to whatever level you like. You should be free to fortify your borders in the West, you know, build various defensive fortifications there and so on. That's perfectly fine with us. Because if that ever happened, then there will be no way to keep Germany from expanding in the East, from developing so much power that France would be reduced to the position of a German satellite at best. So, and in which case, what would the point have been of fighting the war? What would the point have been of these enormous sacrifices that had been made during the war if the result of the war was an even stronger Germany than you had to deal with in 1914? Yeah?
I have a question. If the Treaty of Versailles created Poland again and made it that little buffer zone, like, why would they do that if having Poland gives Germany that buffer from the Soviet Union?
Because they're not thinking in power political terms. They're thinking in ideological terms. We believe in self-determination. We think all of the problems in Europe have to do with the fact that there are these terrible, repressive, undemocratic political systems, and that all these subject nationalities, the Poles, the Serbs, and so on, had all been kept down by this previous semi-feudal political structure. Let's sweep it all away. If you want a peaceful world, the key to a peaceful world is you've got to extend democracy, base everything on the principle of self-determination. I don't know how many of you saw this morning. I was just watching Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testifying before Congress about this whole business in Libya, and it was the whole thing about how the only real solution to the problems the United States faces in the world is to extend democracy, to extend all of our liberal institutions. You know, and actually, your friend Senator Boxer was talking with her about how wonderful it is that she's been such a great champion of women's rights in the Muslim world, and all this kind of thing. It's like, and I was thinking, doesn't it occur to any of these people that this attempt to impose our own values, our own political institutions, on a very different culture, might have some negative consequences, that there might be some pushback from countries that don't like to have American values imposed on them. My point is, you just see this stuff. This is not just this period. This is very basic to American policy. And this is why we're dealing with this key issue, It's like this issue of, are all those liberal views about how foreign policy should be conducted, the United States should behave in the world, how foreign policy should be based on these ideological considerations, are they the views that we should buy into, right? And put it this way, isn't there another way of looking at these issues? And how do you go about weighing these different lines of arguments against each other? And as you know, the whole premise of this course is that there's one and only one way to do that. And that's by looking at these ideological notions in particular historical contexts, like 1919. That's why this whole business of polling is like, you could see it right away. That creating Poland is going to have certain detrimental geopolitical effects from the standpoint of the Western powers. They do it anyway because they believe that the Poles have a right to an independent nation. And we're going to be blind to the geopolitical consequences. Then they come back to us and it's like, I'm shocked. I'm shocked to discover that there's instability in the system. It's like, although the scene from Casablanca where the prefect of police comes in and wants to close down the casino, and they say, well, on what pretext? What's your rationale? He says, well, I'm shocked to discover that there's gambling going on in this casino. It's like you see this stuff over and over again. He's like, well, there were some other hands, yeah?
Can you just explain what it is about having creation of Poland, why that put Germany in a stronger position?
Okay. Suppose Poland didn't exist. Suppose it was the 1914 border, this green line over here, right? Then Germany, she's going to have to worry about what Russia's going to do to her. And that worry is going to force the Germans to moderate their position, worry more about maintaining relatively good relations with Britain and France and so on, right? If you have to worry about a threat on your east, that's going to be factored into your policy and lead to greater moderation. If you don't have to worry about it, you have a free hand, a much freer hand to do whatever you want. Right. A lot of people say, well, why was Versailles so unstable? And they say, oh, it was because it was so harsh. This is a harsh treaty. I'll get you in a sec. What's harsher from the standpoint of German power? The Versailles system, which left Germany intact as a sovereign independent state, unified, or the 1945 arrangement where Germany is divided and West Germany, the real Germany, has to concern itself with a massive Soviet military presence on her eastern border, right? 1945 system, the divided Germany, the limits on German power, which persist to the present day, by the way, this is much harsher, limited German power in much more severe ways than the 1919 system. And yet the 1945 system was more stable. Why was it more stable? Because the Germans had to worry about Russia after 1945. Because they were worried about Russia, they were dependent on us. And therefore, we were able to call the shots. Right? You could see how the geopolitical environment plays a fundamental role in shaping policy and limiting what countries could do. Now, you had your hand up?
Yeah, and my question was, after World War I, with all the reparations, how are they still able to have that same war-making power?
How are they still able to have that same war-making power? As long as the constraints are in existence, they don't have the war-making power. As long as they can't rearm, as long as they're threatened with a French invasion, if they do try and rearm, then there's a limit to what they could do. But if they're able to overthrow the Versailles system, then what's going to force them to continue paying the reparations? They eventually stop paying the reparations, and then nothing happens, right? Well, if you can throw off all these constraints, then boy, Germany's going to overwhelm Europe and be relatively stronger vis-a-vis the rest of Europe than she had been even in 1914. But we'll talk about the reparations a bit more. Anyone else? I thought there was, yeah.
The U.S. thinking in power critical terms, because the whole point of the Versailles Treaty was to weaken Germany, right?
The fact that it had that effect doesn't mean that Wilson was thinking in power political terms and that the goal was to weaken Germany. If the goal had been to punish Germany for her crimes, right, it could still have that same effect of legitimating these constraints on German power. But Wilson does not think in power political terms. He would be very upset if anyone ever said that he did. He thinks that all this stuff is poison in the system. He thinks 19th century European policy with balance of power and the Treaty of Vienna with all that stuff that didn't pay attention to self-determination. This stuff was the problem, according to Wilson, right? And, you know, one of your jobs in a course like this is to figure out, well, you know, is he right or is Kennan right in the kind of criticism he made of that sort of policy? Was there another hand up there? No? Oh, you just were stretching. Okay. All right. The point here is to just get you to see that the essence of the Versailles system, the system established by the Treaty of Versailles, was that German power would be constrained. The Versailles system was a set of constraints on German power to keep Germany down, because absent those constraints, there would be no way to prevent Germany from once again dominating Europe, overwhelming Europe, relatively stronger even than she had been in 1914. The constraints on German power: Germany can't rearm, very small army, no air force, very small navy. All right. Can't defend herself in the West. Can't remilitarize the Rhineland. Has to accept an Allied military presence in the Rhineland, for like 15 years. And I should say, why is this important? Why is it important that Allied military forces, especially French military forces, are right in this area? The Rhineland is this hatched area there on the map. Right? It's because the industrial heart of Germany, the Ruhr Basin, the heart of the German industrial economy. This is where German steel is produced, the great bulk of it, and all kinds of finishing industries that produce machinery based on raw steel. They've grown up around the coal mines and the steel mills, right? This is the industrial heart of Germany, and it's the Ruhr Basin is this area right here. It's like very close to the Rhineland with these French troops there. So the French basically have a knife just very close to Germany's throat, can threaten to throw Germany into economic chaos. And we'll see. This is what happens in 1923. Okay. The Versailles system, a set of constraints on German power. As long as the Versailles system is enforced, Germany can't pose the kind of threat that she would pose absent those constraints. Yeah?
So if the Versailles system was a system of constraints to limit German power, wouldn't that be thinking in power political terms?
Well, the French certainly did. The French, Clemenceau, for reasons I was suggesting, a lot of them having to do with France's own geographical and power political position, was much more inclined to think in those terms than the Americans or even the British, who are much more shielded from this sort of thing. But But the power political problem, the problem of French security, the problem of what would happen if the constraints were removed, that's a problem that you could deal with in more than one way, not just through a harsh treatment of Germany by having these ironclad constraints limiting German power. You could all, there, the French preference was, you deal with this problem by maintaining the wartime coalition. The Americans and the British aren't willing to go along with it. And so the French are faced with, well, what are we supposed to do? They have the hard line as an option, but they're also willing to consider, well, maybe we could reach some sort of accommodation with Germany, a la, you know, the Schuman Plan and all that stuff after World War II, you know, the basis of the current European Union. There were people in 1919 even who were thinking along those lines, and both France and Germany, by the way. I'm going to come back to this because this is an important part of this story. And so there are these efforts at Franco-German accommodation. But you're right. The French are thinking in power political terms. But the Americans and the British are not thinking in terms of how do you deal with this problem of German power? How do you create a stable structure of power in Europe? Because their minds are in that place. Yeah? Versailles system, set of constraints on German power. And everyone should know what those constraints are. What we're going to look at today is the period that was dominated by a struggle over the question of whether the Versailles system would be maintained intact, whether the system of constraints on German power would remain the heart of the European political system, or whether Germany would be able to throw off what the Germans referred to as the shackles of Versailles and re-emerge as by far the number one power on the continent of Europe. Okay. Yeah.
Did this include the USSR, like this number one power on Europe?
Germany is intrinsically, if these constraints disappeared, Germany would clearly be a stronger country than the USSR. Russia's in bad shape. First of all, Tsarist Russia was by far the most primitive of all the European countries. The measure of Russian power was that even as part of a coalition with Britain and France, Russia couldn't even survive in the war. Even though Germany had to fight a major war in the West, the bulk of Germany's military effort was in the West. Even with a limited German force deployed against Russia, the Germans still defeated Russia, were able to bring down the Tsarist regime, were able to dictate terms of peace to the successor regime. And it took a massive effort under Stalin to transform Russia into a major industrial and therefore a military power. But even then, by 1941, the Soviets were not able to hold their own against Germany. Well, they prevailed in the end, but it was kind of touch and go. Soviet Union, you can't think in terms of the Soviet Union that we came to know and love during the Cold War. This was a state that was preoccupied with its own internal problems, with building up an economic infrastructure that would enable it to hold its own in the world. By the way, that's the way the whole Stalin phenomenon has to be understood. All the horrors of the Stalin period. You can't make sense of them without realizing that the Soviets understood that there was this major German threat. You know, why do you have to have this very brutal, forced-paced process of industrialization? Because you needed heavy industry to come into being that could provide you with the tools of dealing with a German invasion. All right, any other questions? Let's move ahead. Versailles system of constraints on German power. Are the Germans going to accept it? Well, what determines whether the Germans would accept these arrangements? Very unequal arrangements. The Allies had all these political rights that Germany didn't have. The Allies could build up their military power to whatever level they wanted. Germany couldn't. Why shouldn't Germany have the same political rights as the victor powers? Right? Why did the Germans resist? Because believe me, resist they did. Well, part of the reason was moral. Right? Part of the reason had to do with the fact that the Germans felt that there was no moral validity to the treaty. I mean, for all kinds of reasons here. It's like, first, they did not surrender unconditionally. The Allies did not legitimately have a free hand to do whatever they wanted to Germany. There was this pre-armistice agreement. The Allies agreed to make peace on the basis of the Wilson Peace Program with only these two exceptions. You know, and one of them had to do with the reparations, and Germany was supposed to just pay damages for, you know, pay compensation for the damage done to the civilian population of the Allies. And it was felt, not just by the Germans, but by a lot of people in the West, including Wilson's own advisors at the peace conference, that the inclusion of the pensions in the bill, which doubled the size of the reparation bill, was a violation of the pre-armistice agreement, that had no moral validity. Okay? That was one thing. There, then there was a whole notion that the unequal treatment of Germany, the fact that Germany was not given the same political rights as everyone else, but was to be kept down for at least a generation. This was based on the idea that the Germans, it was legitimate to treat the Germans that way because they had caused the war. Right? They were guilty. The war had been a crime. They had caused it. They were to be blamed for it, responsible for it. And it was the fact that the Germans were responsible for the war that was the basis for the provided the moral basis for the Versailles system. Because if Germany had not caused the war and was no more responsible than anyone else, then what right do the Western powers have to kind of impose these terms on Germany and prevent Germany from having an equal place in the post-war international order, right? No right at all. Germany was no more guilty for the war than anyone else. Then you really should have had a peace of reconciliation, a peace based on the notion that everyone was to be treated equally, the same set of standards. The Germans felt like they have a double standard. There's one standard that applies when it's a question of giving Alsace-Lorraine back to the French. Another standard applies when it's a question of giving these areas that spoke a dialect of Polish but thought of themselves as Germans, they're giving them to the Poles. And principle of self-determination, but the Austrians weren't to have the right to determine whether they should be part of Germany or not. You know, long list of these examples of double standards and allied hypocrisy and so on. They claimed they were standing for freedom of the seas, but then, you know, that was supposedly why the Americans came into the war, but that was so dishonest because when it was a question of the British Navy violating the laws of war to kind of starve out the Germans by preventing food deliveries to Germany during the war, no one made a peep about that. You know, so there was a lot of bitterness on the part of the Germans, well taken bitterness about the Versailles system. They blame us for the war, but what evidence do they have? No one's even gone through the documents from that period. And so the Germans, one of their first moves was to begin publishing, albeit in a somewhat selective fashion, their documents on the origins of the war, especially on the July crisis in 1914. Right? And this led to this one of the greatest historiographical debates of all time, the whole debate about the origins of the First World War, which is still not over, and there's still interesting work that's coming out relating to this issue. All right, so Germans had a moral basis for opposing the treaty. But they also had a moral basis after 1945 for opposing the post-war settlement that was imposed upon them. He said, don't we have the same right to self-determination as everyone else? Why should we be forced to accept a division of our country with half of our country under the rule of an alien power, the Soviet Union? These moral considerations they're part of the story, and it's important to bear them in mind. But they are by no means the whole story. Right? They're also taking their measure of what's possible in power political terms. What's the structure of power? Is it possible for us, given power political realities, to resist the Versailles system? Or if we try to resist, is the hammer going to just slam down hard on our heads? Right? And here, the answer is, they took their measure of the forces arrayed against them, and they came to the conclusion that those forces weren't all that strong. What are the forces arrayed against them? Again, not Russia. They don't have to worry about Russia anymore for all the reasons that we discussed. The only real counterweight to German power, or obstacle to a resurgence of German power, the only real force behind the Versailles system is the French army. But France is basically a weaker country than Germany. And France, in the long run, feels kind of dependent on her wartime allies, Britain and America. And Britain and America, they're not only no longer willing to support a policy of enforcement of the treaty, a policy of keeping Germany down, but they put all this pressure on France to take it easy with enforcement, to not, you know, use force against Germany. Again, remember I was talking about this kind of fundamental contradiction that lies at the heart of the Wilsonian policy in 1919? Yeah, Germany should be punished, so we're going to have a punitive peace. But force is not a legitimate element in normal international politics. It's legitimate only after an aggressor causes a war, and then you go in with unstinted force. So, but in normal political life, you're not supposed to use military force, because if you use military force, well, that's militarism, that's bad. Right? And so, so the United States and the British, to a certain extent, are averse to the use of force to compel Germany to comply with the terms of the treaty. Right? And so you have this this shift in the year 1920, well before the change of administration, on the part of both Britain and the United States, away from the punitive policies that they had pursued at the time of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, to a policy that was directed toward preventing the French from enforcing the terms of peace and moving toward reconciliation of sorts with Germany. The treaty terms have to be revised, right? And this puts pressure on France, because France senses in the long run that her security, a key to her security, is relatively decent relations with the two English-speaking democracies, Britain and America. Okay? How does opinion change? Mainly, it's a product of German resistance. Germans begin to resist the treaty in minor ways, almost as soon as it's presented to them, before it's even signed. Wilson's very upset by this. He didn't expect it. But it forces him to make a choice, justice or reconciliation. You know, the use of force, the enforcement of the treaty, or the alteration of the basic nature of the post-war peace. Movement toward an accommodation with the Germans, or the attempt to kind of really stand up and force the Germans to pay for their crimes. And since it was becoming very clear that to get the Germans to go along with the treaty, you know, the knife would just have to be kept to their throats forever, that they weren't going to accept this thing voluntarily, and you had to be prepared to use force against them, the sense was, this is just going to poison international political life. among other things, it's going to prevent the bourgeois countries from coming together to deal with this new threat that people sensed emerging in the East, the communist threat. That was an element to it. It's not all there was to it. There was also an economic element to it. The war had universally been financed through inflationary practices, vast expansion of the monetary supply. And then after the war, the notion was you had to kind of return to sound money. And both Britain and America slammed on the deflationary brakes in 1920. There was a sharp depression as a result of that. In 1920, the level of unemployment was as high as it was during the Great Depression. It didn't last as long, though. Right. And these governments were not willing to say, well, this is a product of our own macroeconomic policies, our monetary and fiscal policies. All this economic dislocation, all this unemployment, economic turmoil, this is because of the kind of peace that was imposed on Germany. The makers of the Versailles Peace, they had no understanding of economics. This is a famous argument made by the single most famous economist of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes. He had been part of the British delegation at the peace conference late 1919. He came back furious, wrote this polemic called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, made these arguments. These peace terms, instead of reestablishing a viable international economic order, they're going to screw everything up. The reparations especially going to mess everything up. So this provided people with a very convenient scapegoat for saying, well, that's the cause of our economic problems. We want to solve our economic problems. The way to do it is to get the French to scale back on their impossible reparation demands and so on. No one quite knew in those days what the reality was of the reparation negotiations at the peace conference itself. It was politically convenient to blame the French rather than take responsibility for these policies themselves. And so you have this shift on the part of Britain and America. This encourages the Germans. What's really standing in our way? We want to kind of break throw off the shackles of Versailles. It's only the French army. The French are kind of held back by their former allies. The French don't really have the stomach for a violent campaign against us. It might be tough for a couple of years, but once we break through, then we'll achieve the position in Europe to which we're entitled, the same political rights as everyone else. We'll be able to undo all the injustices that have been inflicted on us at Versailles, and so on and so on. So you have this German resistance leading to this shift in British and American opinion, and so on. Okay. So there's a struggle. Germans are encouraged. The French are a little held back. Who's going to win? Now, I said a number of times in this class that the history might be very interesting, but we're using it as a vehicle for getting at these fundamental theoretical questions. Okay? These questions about realism, liberalism, how foreign policy should be conducted, what makes for a stable international order. And in this case, we're going to look at the post-1919 period from that perspective. What does this tell us about those big issues of international relations theory? The realist approach to this problem is to not look for who the bad guys are, who should be blamed for the problem, the vengeful French or, the Germans who just had this, will to power and so on. The realist approach tends to accept political conflict philosophically as built into the fundamental structure of the system. It was natural that the Germans would want to resist the Versailles system because they would want, naturally, to be able to provide for their own security. Right? It's natural that they would not accept a situation where they were permanently under the thumb of the French. Right? resistance was natural. It was equally natural that the French would not want to just give the Germans everything they wanted on a silver platter. It was natural that the French would be worried about the implications for them of the dismantling of the Versailles system, the reemergence of Germany as by far the strongest power in the continent of Europe, that the French would ask themselves, if we're willing to go along with that, what was the point of fighting the war? What was the point of making these massive sacrifices if Germany is going to be relatively stronger now than she had been even in 1914? It was natural that the French would want to prevent Versailles from simply collapsing in that way. So the conflict that you would have over the Versailles system from the realist point of view is totally understandable. You don't have to blame one side or the other, right? It's wrong to approach this problem in moralistic terms, looking for you see an international conflict, who should we point the finger at, right? The assumption is that way of looking at things is itself destructive of stability. Is that view valid? I think that the more you get into the evidence relating to this 1919 to 23 period, the more you're struck with the conclusion that that's the way this thing should be understood. And of course, it's easy for an American, as an outsider, to take that view. Easier it is than for a Frenchman or for German to kind of look at things in that light. All right. But anyway, I actually thought I would get much further today. In the 2 minutes remaining, and then in the lecture next time, I want to kind of talk about this conflict to kind of show you how it has to be understood in that context. And then in particular, the view that one got from the larger culture about how these conflicts have to be understood in terms of a vengeful France determined to, keep Germany down and exact impossible reparation payments from Germany. How that's not... That's not a legitimate way of looking at things. Yeah?
Wasn't it the British who wanted to increase the...
In 1919, but British policy shifted in 1920.
Oh.
Right? They changed about all of this stuff. Okay. If you're Germany, and if you see this problem, and if you decide that you want to test the waters and you want to pursue a policy of resisting the peace terms with the goal of throwing off what you view as the shackles of Versailles, the Versailles constraints, how would you proceed? What would you do? Well, you're not going to mindlessly resist the treaty in every single area, regardless of consequence. You would want to pursue a more intelligent strategy by focusing your efforts on that area of the Versailles system that was most vulnerable to resistance, where resistance was easiest, where you'd have the most support and sympathy abroad, and where resistance was most likely to be productive in terms of the goals you would want to achieve. And what area would that be? Could they say, we can't not demilitarize the Rhineland? Obviously they could. They can't say, we can't dismantle our fortresses. That's obviously within their capability. Or we can't not build up a large army. because it's very clear no one is going to accept those arguments. They're going to focus on that area of the Versailles system where resistance is easiest, and that area is the reparations. Because a lot of people in the West say, well, Germany can't pay the reparations. It's natural they're not paying. It's awful for the French to try and make the Germans pay the reparations. It's easiest for them to resist in this area. And that's precisely what happens in this period, 1919 to 1923. That's where German resistance is concentrated. This whole period, 1919 to 1923, is dominated by the struggle over reparations. Not because the money, although it was important, was of fundamental significance in its own terms. It was important for political and not for economic reasons. It was important because the struggle against the reparations on Germany's part and the struggle to prevent the reparation settlement from totally collapsing on France's part had this fundamental political dimension, that the goal was to maintain the Versailles system intact, to keep German power from overwhelming the power of the rest of Europe, to keep Germany from dominating France. That's why this stuff was so important. That's why it played such a central political role in this period. Okay, well, I'm out of time for today. I'll pick up with this stuff next time and talk about the conflict over reparations culminating in the Ruhr crisis and then try and take us into the Locarno period, too.
Professor?
Hold on.